Venezuelan National Assembly's Economic and Financial Advisory Office under the late President Hugo Chavez. We welcome you back to Democracy Now!, Francisco Rodriguez. Can you lay out what you feel, how these sanctions connect to the migration to the United States from Venezuela and Cuba?
Yes. Good morning, Amy. Thanks for having me on the show. Effectively, there is significant evidence surveyed in the report that I just authored, as well as in other academic studies, that economic sanctions have an adverse effect, a major adverse effect on living conditions in target countries. Some of the studies find that the imposition of sanctions by the U.S. Leads to a decline in income per capita of up to 26%. That's the equivalent of causing a Great Depression. Another study found increases or declines in life expectancy of between 1.2 and 1.4 years. That's the equivalent of the mortality effects of the COVID pandemic. So when sanctions are imposed on a country like Venezuela and like Cuba, they lead to a major economic contraction. And Venezuela GDP per capita has fallen by 72%. And this has generated a massive exodus. Almost 25% of the population has left, and many of them are trying to make their way to the border and trying to enter the United States. So definitely we have economically induced migration in both of these countries, and there's a strong contribution of economic sanctions. In the case of Venezuela, sanctions have targeted the oil industry. The oil industry produces 95% of the country's foreign currency revenue. So if the country can't sell oil, it can't import basic goods, it can't import food, it can't import medicines. So living conditions deteriorate markedly, and that's why people want to leave.
So the Biden administration has said it's willing to lift some sanctions against Venezuela in exchange for steps taken by Nicolas Maduro's government, such as not banning opposition candidates from running against him. But most of the sanctions that Biden inherited from Trump remain in place. Your response, and talk about how the humanitarian crisis is increased at home as well in Venezuela by these sanctions.
Yeah, well, I think that that response is basically making vulnerable Venezuelans, those who are more oppressed by Maduro, pay the cost of these actions. So to say we're going to lift sanctions which are hurting Venezuelans if Maduro takes steps towards democracy, well, Maduro is probably not going to take those steps. And the people who are going to pay the cost are the Venezuelans and are vulnerable Venezuelans. And you've seen huge deteriorations, huge increases in levels of malnutrition, of mortality, both adult and child mortality in Venezuela. You've seen deteriorations, a decline in wages, where wages have fallen below $5 a month. And all of this, I must stress, is driven by a decline in oil revenues. So Venezuela's economy shrank by 72% in the same period in which oil revenues declined by 93%. And while the cause of the decline in oil revenues, I mean, there are several causes. I'm not claiming in any way that sanctions are the only one, but there's research showing that sanctions have a major effect on oil production. Sanctions, the imposition of sanctions in August 2017, in January of 2019, in February of 2020, is in every single instance associated with accelerations in the rate of decline of oil production. So it's clear that Venezuela doesn't have the foreign currency revenue that it needs in order to keep its economy working and feed its people. And a great part of the responsibility of this lies on U.S. economic sanctions.
Can you also talk about how last year London's high court ruled against Venezuela's president, Maduro, in a $1 billion gold battle? What effect does that have?
Yeah. Well, it has a significant effect, but it's symptomatic of a broader problem, which is that one of the reasons why the Venezuelan government has been unable to deal with the pandemic and unable to deal with recession is that it doesn't have access to its international funds. And those funds, it's barred from access to them, not just because of sanctions, but because of the decision of the United States and the United Kingdom to recognize the government of Juan Guaido, an opposition leader who claimed that he was a legitimate president of Venezuela. And the U.S. and the U.K. broke completely with diplomatic convention when they did this. Typically, what governments do is that they recognize the government that has de facto control over the territory, even if you don't like it, because you realize that that's the government that you need to engage with. So the U.S. recognizes many dictatorships around the world. It recognizes the government of North Korea. It recognizes the government of Iran. But it decided to recognize the Guaido government, and so did the U.K., therefore handing it over control over assets such as the international reserves of the central bank, which is what Venezuela needs to address its economic crisis. Venezuela made a proposal to use those reserves in the Bank of England to buy vaccines in the midst of the COVID crisis, but that was rejected because the court is trying to clarify whether what will be the result of that suit, which is a lawsuit between the central bank board that was appointed by the Maduro government and an alternate central bank board that was appointed by the Guaido government. We have a similar problem in the International Monetary Fund. Venezuela did not have access to the funds to fight the COVID emergency that were created by the issuance of special drawing rights at the International Monetary Fund, and that's because the U.S. has blocked recognition of the government that has control of the territory, which is the Maduro government. It's insisted that the legitimate government, even though the Guaido government has already been dissolved, it's still insisting that the Maduro government not have access to the resources that the IMF approved for all countries to be able to fight the pandemic. So the U.S. spent 25% of GDP in dealing with the pandemic. Latin America spent less than 5% because it didn't have access to the same resources. Venezuela was able to spend less than 1% of its GDP because it was unable to tap the resources that the international community had created and allocated to deal with this emergency.
We don't have much time left, but your report also not only looks at sanctions against Venezuela, against Cuba, but Syria and what that meant, especially with the earthquake that just hit.
The result surveys 32 studies, of which 30 find negative, consistent effects of sanctions on indicators ranging from GDP per capita to mortality, life expectancy, living conditions in general. In the case of Syria, we have seen also very significant negative effects. And in fact, sanctions have interfered with earthquake relief. Earlier in the year, GoFundMe actually suspended any attempts, any account requesting the raising of funds for Syria earthquake relief. And that was as a response. It's a phenomenon known as overcompliance. It's not, the U.S. claims that there are humanitarian exceptions and it puts humanitarian exceptions in the regulations that it publishes. But the reality is that the exceptions are so vague and so hard to follow that most financial institutions say, we're not going to take the risk of getting into trouble and we're not going to process transactions for countries like Syria. And therefore, you see that, and you see this systematically across the board, the humanitarian exceptions are not effective. And in the case of Iran, for example, you found that the medicines that were not available in Iran during the periods of sanctions, out of 73 medicines, 70 of them were in the OFAC exemptions list. But it's still the case that no bank would process the transactions, given that the country was a sanctioned country. So sanctions impede the access to funds that are necessary to cover humanitarian aid in cases of emergency relief, such as those of the Syria earthquake.
Francisco Rodriguez, I want to thank you for that very quick analysis of the effect of sanctions from Venezuela to Syria. Venezuelan economist, thank you so much for being with us from the University of Denver, speaking to us from Aurora. He headed the National Assembly's Economic and Financial Advisory Office under Venezuela's late President Hugo Chavez. His new report for the Center for Economic Policy and Research is titled The Human Consequences of Economic Sanctions. Coming up, Pakistan's former Prime Minister Imran Khan has been freed after his arrest sparked mass protests and a number of deaths. Stay with us.
Support the Second Amendment in front of second graders. They get shot, turning Red Rover, playing hot potato. These grown men won't enter rooms, say we'll stop them later. You stop the data, no matter what the new cases. Identifying by DNA and shoelaces. He say we move forward, backwards two paces. All these right. right-wing governors in the school faces, with all these young kids suffering, making new statements, lobbying for law changes, getting hounded and accused. Now who really is abused, indoctrinated to stop debating? Only right and wrong answers if you ask DeSantis. Watch a fascist on campus, doesn't like the colors flashed on canvas. Got the mask on, managed to avoid lung damage, but it won't block a gunshot. Can't drink a beer, but your son's got a gun cock. Don't talk to me about a knife fight when 25 are getting dumped off in a matter of seconds, yet we can't ban a bump stock. A one drop of blood's never bled from your family. Every nation knows it's America's calamity. Make money, money, making lots of guns. Make money, money, making lots of guns. Shaking all you down, taking lots of fun.
Tons of Guns 23 by Darius Rhodes and Reason. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to Pakistan. Earlier today, the Islamabad High Court granted bail for 2 weeks to former Pakistani Prime Minister Imran Khan, whose arrest earlier this week sparked mass protests. On Tuesday, paramilitary forces arrested Khan on corruption charges, but then on Thursday, Pakistan's Supreme Court ruled his arrest was invalid and unlawful. Khan had served as Pakistan's prime minister from 2018 to 2022, when he was ousted from office in what he described as a, quote, U.S.-backed regime change plot backed by his opposition. He's now blamed the military. Supporters of his political party, the PTI, say the latest charges are politically motivated and part of a broader campaign to silence Khan. In an attempt to quell the protests, Pakistan's police issued an emergency order earlier today to ban gatherings in Islamabad. Pakistan has also suspended mobile broadband and blocked access to social media apps, disrupting the lives of millions. Meanwhile, human rights groups accuse Pakistani forces of using excessive force on supporters of Imran Khan, who've taken to the streets in recent days. At least 10 protesters have been killed. Nearly 3,000 Khan supporters have been arrested. We're joined now by Mohammed Hanif. He's an award-winning writer and journalist based in Karachi. He's the former editor of the BBC Urdu service in London, where he's joining us from today. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Mohammed Hanif. It's great to have you with us. Explain what's happening. Why was Imran Khan arrested, and now why was he released?
I think they've been trying to arrest Imran Khan for quite a few months now. The main purpose is quite obvious. Elections are due. And they want to keep him out of the electoral race. Either they want to disqualify him or they want to put him behind bars. That seems to be the obvious purpose, because he was just thrown out of the government a year ago. And since then, he has been on a war path. And that's not new. Almost every single prime minister in Pakistan's history at some point has fallen out with the army, which is considered the all-powerful in Pakistan. But what Imran Khan has managed to do is that he's managed to polarize what's called establishment in Pakistan, which is the higher judiciary and military itself. So people were hoping that after they put him behind bars, they'll be managed to throw away the key, and that's where he will stay. But he was there under arrest for 2 days, and then Supreme Court, the Chief Justice himself called him, said, "I'm very happy to see you." Then from a lockup, put him into a state guest house, asked him to basically invite his friends over and have an easy night's sleep. And then today he appeared in the court again, and he was granted bail. So now he's a free man to move. So basically what Imran Khan has managed to achieve is, which no other politician has, I think, in the past, is that he's managed to polarize the establishment itself. So they don't quite know what to do with him, because they put him behind the bars. And as Imran Khan has warned, if you arrest me, the country will burn. And the country did burn. And now they've released him. But there are dozens and dozens of cases against him. Some very flimsy, some substantial, and I think they will probably go after him again.
He seems to be extremely popular throughout Pakistan. Can you explain who his supporters are and just give us the overall political landscape, why at this point they arrested him?
We keep hearing that he is extremely popular, and the interesting thing is that he's popular amongst people who are basically used to be a bit apolitical. In every democracy, there's a chunk of people who actually hate politics. So there were lots of haters in Pakistan who did not like the way things were going. And they're usually middle-class people, a lot of them. They're people, lots of women who are politically disengaged, lots of young people who were not interested in politics or just hated the idea of these old politicians who've been running the country. These were also the same people who loved the army. And when Imran Khan came into power, it was a quite well-known fact that he was groomed by the army. He was supported by the army. While he was in power, he said repeatedly that he and army, they were on one page. In fact, he's basically confessed that he was a puppet for the army. That everything that he did while he was in power, he did because army told him to do so. But when he was thrown out of power after a no confidence vote, he went on a war path. So all this, all these people who were supporting him and supporting the army, now they have turned against the army. So look at it like a lover's quarrel. And those quarrels can be very, very bitter and sometimes very violent. So that's why we saw what we saw in Lahore. The army commander who basically controls Lahore and in a way is kind of, you know, sort of probably more powerful than any politician in Lahore. His house was ransacked, set on fire. It was looted. So army is probably just beginning to realize that they have created something that they cannot control anymore.
Imran Khan described the coup that replaced him as a U.S.-backed regime change, but then seemed to shift and blame the Pakistani military. Can you explain the dynamic there?
A fun fact about Imran Khan is that he can say something today, and he can say completely opposite tomorrow, and his supporters would still love him. So he's a man that you cannot accuse of that he's contradicting himself. Because that is not his weakness, that's almost his strength. So when he was removed, he did say that it was a U.S.-backed conspiracy. Then he changed his mind very many times. He said that it was Pakistani generals who were traitors, who betrayed him and betrayed the country. He's called them all kinds of names. And since then, we keep hearing, you guys probably know this better, that he's been hiring lobbyists in Washington, D.C. to kind of to smooth things over with the United States establishment. I don't even know if they're interested or not. But as a Pakistani, one thing that I found a bit scary in the last few weeks is that there's this dude called Zalme Khalilzad, is I think his name, who kind of first tried to liberate Iraq and then Afghanistan. And we both know what happened there. So
was the U.S. ambassador to Afghanistan?
Yes, he was. So and then before, I think he was involved somehow in Iraq as well. So every time we hear his name, we hear mass murder, basically, of world class. So he's somebody who's been campaigning on his behalf. I have no idea whether he's a paid lobbyist or just because he's out of job. And he's looking for another cause, another country to save. So I would only, as a citizen, say that God save Pakistan from Zalme Khalilzad and likes of him.
Do you fear a military takeover in Pakistan now, or would you say that's already happened?
I think Pakistan is in such a big economic mess right now. I mean, till last month and even now, people are standing in long queues just to purchase, you know, flour to make their bread. And things are so bad that they haven't been so bad in a long time. And army would have moved in if they knew that they could handle the country economically, and which they can't. Things are as desperate as they can be. So they kind of, they are trying to run things, but it seems that they can't anymore. And if they resort to brute force, which they have done in the past, I think we will get into probably a much bigger mess than we are in right now. And I think probably army fears that too. So I don't think there will be any direct takeover by the army. They will try to do what they've been doing in the past. They'll stay on the sidelines, and they will try to run things. But increasingly, it seems that they're not able to do what they've been able to do in the past.
Mohammad Hanif, I want to thank you for being with us, award-winning Pakistani writer and journalist based in Karachi, former editor of the BBC Urdu service in London, speaking to us from London. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. We end today's show in Serbia, which is reeling from a pair of mass shootings that left 17 people dead. On May 3rd, a 13-year-old boy, a student, went on a rampage at a school in the capital, Belgrade, killing 8 students and a school guard. It was Serbia's first mass school shooting. The following day, a 21-year-old Serbian man shot dead 8 people nearby. The shooting shocked the country and led to quick calls for sweeping gun control measures. And Serbia's President Aleksandar Vučić vowed to completely disarm the country. More than 6,000 unregistered guns and weapons have already been turned in after the government announced a month-long amnesty on illegal weapons. Nearly 300,000 rounds of ammunition have also been surrendered. We go now to the Serbian journalist, Liljana Smalovic. She is a former editor of Politika, the oldest daily newspaper in the Balkans, also is a columnist for Belgrade Political Weekly magazine. We welcome you back to Democracy Now!, Liljana. Thank you so much for being with us. Can you first lay out what happened and then the country's response, the population? In fact, there's about to be yet another anti-gun mass mobilization in Belgrade today.
First time, you know, their sense of security has been taken away completely. So what they're thinking now is my child safe at school? This other mass murder happened in a sleepy little suburb of Belgrade. They're wondering, can we still meet up late with neighbors and walk home afterwards? So there's this shock and surprise and something that's never happened before that takes
looks like we Liljana was frozen in her Skype last week after 17 people were killed in the 2 mass shootings, including 8 children. Tens of thousands of people joined protests against gun violence in Belgrade, demanding top government officials resign. This is a protester.
It is tragic that so many kids killed by their peers were buried in a short period of time. This is a low point. We are already used to what happens in Texas, but there, weapons are openly purchased. And here, where do they get the firearms? It is a disaster.
Liljana Smilovic, if you could respond to what he's saying. We're still having trouble with getting Liljana. This is the Serbian president, Aleksandar Vučić, speaking last week at a news conference in Belgrade after both mass shootings.
Everyone who has a weapon, and that's around 400,000 individuals, and I'm not talking about hunting weapons, will have to go through revision, and after there won't be more than 30,000 to 40,000 of them. We'll practically conduct a complete disarmament of Serbia. For owning an illegal weapon, penalties will be much more severe, almost double. Of course, even that will not be enough for the small number of weapons that will remain. For hunters, who are usually more disciplined, and for everyone else, we will conduct biannual and annual exams of gun owners, including medical, psychiatric, and psychological evaluations. If deemed necessary by the authorities, a substance use test will be conducted within 48 hours.
Let's see if we have Liljana Smilovic back. And if we do, it seems like Serbia is mobilizing against gun violence much faster than the United States. You've had two mass shootings. We have on average at least one a day in the United States. Explain what's happening.
Well, what's happening is that we have a political hegemon in power. He has been in power for over 10 years. He has a majority in parliament. He's a hands-on president. He's also the president of the ruling party. So when he promises something, when he says he's going to move on something, he moves on it, and people know that he can deliver. So the protests, the mass opposition protests that we've had a couple of days ago, and we're expecting another major protest tonight. These protests are not so much against his measures. People, by and large, approve the measures that the president has announced. People are surrendering their weapons en masse. He just announced today that 9,000 weapons were surrendered, which is more than had happened in four previous campaigns of the sort, where people were asked to turn in their unregistered weapons and there would be no consequences if they do. But the protests are really the protests against this long-serving president who is being accused of being a dictator. And he truly politically is omnipotent. So the opposition sees this crisis of people's sense of security as a good opportunity to try to dislodge or destabilize the government and extort some important political concessions. They want several key people in the government that are known as personal choices of the president to be fired. They want two of the most popular political stations to lose their broadcasting licenses, at least for national frequencies, and only to remain cable companies. So they have huge demands, and they figure that this is a good moment to try to win some concessions from a very strong and stable, otherwise stable government.
You are, to say the least, a global observer. You've seen what's happened in the United States, and then you see what's happening in Serbia. How are the mass shootings in the United States perceived from there? And this immediate crackdown on guns, especially illegal guns on the streets of Serbia, like we haven't seen in the United States ever.
We are a society that's just as deeply polarized politically as the United States. So we used to look at the United States and say, oh, that happens there because they have all those weapons and they have these, you know, open carry and all this. But we also felt that we were better and that this kind of thing could not happen here. And immediately there were political accusations. A government minister who was forced to resign said, this is what comes from your so-called Western values. Well, the opposition responded, no, this is what comes from Putinism, from being pro-Russian. So that was the debate. But by and large, people approve of restrictive measures, and they cannot understand that the United States is unable to do anything about their problem. So people are saying, okay, this has not been imported from the United States. We are simply part of the big world. And these are things that happen in that outer world. And some things that are happening in this society have a lot to do with what's happening in other more developed societies, the societies that we are aspiring.
Well, Liljana Smilovic, we're going to have to leave it there. We thank you so much for being with us. Serbian journalist joining us from Belgrade, Serbia, where two mass shootings took place one day after another. One perpetrated by a 13-year-old student who gunned down his classmates and a guard in the school. That does it for our show. A very happy birthday to Aaron Dooley. Democracy Now! Is produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warnoff, Tarina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astujo, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Our director, Becca Staley.
Spark Sustainability Society is an independent, student-centered nonprofit working across SFU campuses. Embark focuses on climate and food justice in their programs and initiatives. Some of their ongoing work includes their food rescue program, learning gardens, and sustainability career nights. Discover your role in building a sustainable future based on your unique skills and interests. Learn more at EmbarkSustainability.org and follow along on Instagram at EmbarkSustain.